We're going to see this morning, get an idea of how thickly sown Jesus' miracles were. We're going to look at a miracle within a miracle. He's halfway through one miracle and he does another miracle. That's how densely done Jesus' miracles were. I'd like to begin, though, this morning talking about an event that took place very early on in Jesus' life. At this point, Jesus had not yet done any miracles. And a few people had ever heard of Jesus other than his friends and family. It was just a normal day in Galilee, and Jesus was about 19 years old. And on this particular day, he was just going about his regular routine in Nazareth, where he grew up. And that same day, just 20 miles away, in the upper class area of Capernaum. And by the way, I have the map here. I don't know if you can see that, but Nazareth is down there south of Louisville. You can think of that as being like Westminster. And what Jesus did last time was cross the sea, across the Sea of Galilee, over to this Gentile area. And now he's crossing back over to Capernaum, which is actually right there. So that's about 20 miles away from where Jesus grew up. So imagine on this particular day in Capernaum, there's a man and a woman who had just had their first child. Turns out would be their only child. A beautiful, healthy little girl. And they invited friends over, and they were all laughing and celebrating and happy. And like most parents, their minds filled with thoughts of the future, hopes and expectations, wondering what life would it turn out to be like for this little one. Now, I want you to listen just for a moment to the sounds of the laughter and the happiness from that house. And now listen as those sounds fade and we move over to another neighborhood in Capernaum a few blocks away, to another house. This house is quiet. Nobody's laughing. A young woman is sitting there by her bed, and she isn't laughing at all. In fact, she's really starting to get scared now. Because, you see, a few weeks ago, she realized that something was wrong with her body. She didn't want to tell anybody at first, but for some reason this month, her bleeding just didn't stop. She has been hemorrhaging now from her womb for several weeks. And she realizes she needs to see a doctor. That would be a concern enough just medically in that day, but for her, there was much more to it than that, because in her culture, that was a considerable problem. You see, there's a passage in the Old Testament, which was the law of the land for the Jews, given by Moses himself directly in Leviticus 15 that addressed this very thing. In verse 25 of that chapter, it says, when a woman has that kind of a bleeding problem, it describes it and says, and she continues, it continues beyond her period, she will be unclean for as long as she has the problem. Any bed she lies on will be unclean. Anything she sits on will be unclean. Anything she touches will be unclean. Anyone who touches those things will be unclean. And then it says, you must keep the Israelites separate from the things that make them unclean so that they will not die in their uncleanness for defiling my holy dwelling place, which is among them. Now, you remember in the Old Testament, God used physical illustrations like this as pictures of the defiling nature of sin. And this is one of those pictures. And so this woman was facing not only the bleak medical prospects of that day, but she was facing life as being a defiling influence on everything and everyone she touched. She'd be banned from the temple. She could not approach the presence of God. And so there she is, sitting in her room, wondering about the future. What if this keeps going? What if it lasts? What if it doesn't stop? What if it goes for weeks and months or years? She would become an outcast. She'd be looked at as a contamination in a society that has looked down on women, had a low enough view of women already. So you have these two houses, and these two people's lives go in very different directions, opposite directions. The man with the new daughter is on a track of success. His daughter was lovely and healthy, and he loves his family. And as the years go by, he takes great joy in watching his little one grow up and mature, and he climbs the social ladder, and eventually, in Capernaum, is elected chairman of the synagogue, which is a very high position. The synagogue in each city had a governing board that elected a chairman, and the guy who was the chairman ended up being a very influential and respected man in the community, and that was this man. The woman, on the other hand, with that problem, her life goes the other way. It turns unbearable. The bleeding never did stop. She went to doctor after doctor, and Mark 5:25 says she suffered at their hands, and the only result was it just got worse. Now she's bleeding all the more. And Luke also says that the doctors got all of her money. interesting, in Dr. Luke's account, he leaves all that out about the doctors, but Mark tells us, and this problem goes on and on. For over a decade, she's got it. Now, the regulation of this problem was considered to be such an important issue for the Jews that if you look in the Mishnah, that work devotes an entire tractate, an entire book, just to this problem. The book of Zabim, and it gives 11 remedies. Some of them are harmless, some not so harmless, almost all of them superstitious. Just a couple of examples. They said she could be cured if she carried barley corn found in the dung of a white female donkey. And if that didn't work, she could try carrying an ostrich egg in a certain kind of cloth. Another one was for her to drink some disgusting concoction and then have someone come up behind her and scare her. Things like that. That's the kind of things they had her doing. I'm sure she tried everything. Nothing worked. And now her family, all her family's money is gone. Her condition is as bad as it's ever been. She's ostracized and pushed out to the margins of society. And she's on her own. Nobody would marry her. If this condition began before she got married, then nobody would marry her. If she was already married when it started, she'd almost certainly be divorced. In that culture, the inability to have children was grounds for divorce, and the Old Testament law forbade her husband to sleep with her in that condition, and so almost certainly she'd be divorced with nobody. Now, back in the other neighborhood, it's been 12 years now. The little girl's 12 years old. And in the Jewish world, when a little girl turned 12, she was a woman. And I don't know what kind of a celebration they had in that time for that, but this was an exciting time. She was at the threshold of her life as an adult, as a woman. So one day, when Jairus, this man's name was Jairus, the chairman, when he was at work, word came to him that his daughter was very sick. He rushed home, found that it was serious and life-threatening. In fact, very life-threatening. Doctors said maybe she has a week or two to live at the most. We should imagine what it was like for Jairus. Now, losing a loved one is a terrible experience any time, but especially the young. To lose a child, an only child, has to be one of life's most devastating pains. She was approaching marriageable age in that culture, and so it would be especially difficult. Beecher says, he calls this the sweetest period of life. Young enough to be a child, old enough to be a companion, mingling the charms of childhood and womanhood. So Jairus would be wrestling here with the thoughts of the horror of the prospect of burying his little girl. Now, what do these two stories have in common? The story of the man with the little girl, and the story of the woman who's bleeding, and then the stories we'll see of Jesus arriving back into Israel, sailing crusty. What does all that have in common? Well, the answer is nothing until today, when all these three will intersect. Now, we left off last week with Jesus and his disciples paddling their boat, bumping along through the corpses of 2,000 dead pigs floating there on their way back to Israel. Jesus had just single-handedly defeated an entire legion of Satan's finest. One point we didn't spend much time with, by the way, on that last week that I wanted to mention is the destructive nature of those demons. You know, when they were in the man, they caused him to destroy himself. He's cutting himself with stones and so on. And then as soon as they were in the pigs, caused them to destroy themselves. They were destructive. And I hope that that's burned in your mind after studying this event, because understanding that is really very helpful in resisting temptation. Next time you face some great temptation, ask yourself, why is Satan doing this? Why is Satan offering me this pleasure? Do you think that the devil's offering you pleasure because he wants you to feel good? No, it's because he wants to destroy you. Satan and his minions stand there in your path offering things that are enticing, and they make it seem like you can't have happiness without them, but he has one reason only for doing that, and it is he wants to absolutely bring you to your utter ruin and destruction. It's not because he wants you to feel good. And knowing that motive is really very helpful in resisting temptation if we can just remind ourselves of the devil's schemes. They're very destructive. Okay, so anyway, verse 21, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, now he's back in Israel, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. And Luke 8:40, in the same account, says the crowd welcomed him because they were expecting him. Perhaps somebody spotted the boat coming and ran and told everyone, and everybody comes. And here's where these two people's paths intersect. They both have a great need. Jairus hears that Jesus is coming in on the boat, and so he shows up, and this woman also hears, and she shows up. And so there's Jesus on the beach there with a big crowd already gathered around him, and suddenly the crowd stirs a little bit because approaching from behind is a very important, significant personality. Verse 22, one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him. A very dramatic picture. Normally, a man like Jairus would not come to Jesus. He would send for Jesus if he wanted to see him. Here he comes in person, falls down on the ground in front of Jesus in worship, just like the man with the demon did. And we find out why in verse 23. He says, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." The man is desperate. Jesus had probably had interaction with this synagogue ruler before, because the synagogue ruler, the chairman of the synagogue board, was the one who was in charge of deciding who would speak in the synagogues, and Jesus had been in Capernaum speaking before, and so they had probably had some interaction, but no record of any kind of reaction like this. But see, he's desperate now. And very often that's what it takes for a person to humble himself at Christ's feet, is just desperation. I mean, how many times have you seen that? How many times will you see a person that just will not hand over the car keys of his life to Christ because he thinks he's in control, until finally he just crashes and burns, has a head-on collision with some disaster in life, then finally says, "Okay, Lord, I guess you can drive." I mean, you see that all the time. That's really what's happening now. The man is desperate, and he comes to Jesus and falls down and worships. In verse 24, you see Jesus' response. Jesus went with him. Just like that. Now, that's unusual. Usually Jesus has some kind of conversation first, puts some kind of barrier first or something like that. Here he goes immediately. We've only seen that one other time before. Remember, it was the centurion. This is so far exactly like the situation with the centurion. The centurion came to Jesus, said, "Heal my servant." Jesus said, "I'll come right away." And that's where the similarity ends, because the centurion said, remember what he said? "No, don't come. I'm not even worthy to have you in my house. You just say the word. I know how authority works. Just say the word. She'll be fine." But this man doesn't do that. For some reason, he thinks that Jesus has to be there in his house on site to heal the daughter. That's the difference between faith and great faith. Jesus responds then at a level commensurate with his faith. He doesn't ask for a healing at a distance, and so he doesn't get one. Jesus just starts walking and making his way towards his house, and so does everyone else. Look at the rest of verse 24. A large crowd followed him and pressed around him, and Luke says the crowds almost crushed him. So this is interesting, funny, kind of a funny scene where they're mashing against him. Jesus goes, the disciple goes, the whole crowd, everyone wants to go. The man who appeals on behalf of his little child has everyone's hearts in his hands. Most people, even the most hard-hearted people, will tend to be responsive and sensitive to the suffering of a child. So the whole crowd starts moving. And the streets were narrow in that area, and so a crowd like this squeezed into a narrow street would make it very difficult to even move. The word that Luke says about crushing Jesus, same word used for the thorns choking out the good plant in the parable. And so the idea is being choked out. Must have been quite a squeeze. And so they're making their way towards Jairus' house. They're just moving through the city of Capernaum, going towards this guy's house. And then here's where the story really gets interesting. It must have already been an excruciating frustration for Jairus in the middle of this pressing crowd. I mean, in today's terms, if you can imagine your dying daughter needing medical attention from the hospital immediately, within moments, and the ambulance gets stuck in heavy traffic, can't go very fast. That's what this would have been like. And in verse 25, that frustration must have turned into even more severe anxiety as the whole procession comes to a complete stop. Jesus stops cold in verse 25. And I don't know if Jairus kept walking for a moment until he realized Jesus stopped and wait and looks back. What's happening here? Verse 25 says, "And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. And instead of getting better, she grew worse. And when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak," Luke says his tassel, "because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, then I will be sozo," literally saved. I think this woman wanted more than just healing. She wanted to be healed, but she wanted to be saved. She wanted, at that moment, what the woman at Simon's house got: forgiveness of sins, a cleansing of her heart, a new heart. This woman has faith. It's not the most mature, informed faith. It's a little on the superstitious side. It's presumptuous. It's uneducated. But I think there is an element of real faith there, even though it's affected by the superstitions of her day. So she thinks if she can touch his clothes, she can be saved by touching the clothes of a holy man. So she grabs his tassel. She can't confront him face to face. She knows that. She's unclean. She can't touch him. She can't touch anyone. So she figures, well, no one will know. Everybody's mashed up against him. I can sneak up from behind, work my way up there, just touch his tassel, and I'll be saved. She's desperate too. And it may be she was fixated on his tassel because, interestingly, something I never noticed before, but the same chapter in the Old Testament that talks about her bleeding condition also establishes tassels as a requirement for Jewish men. She may have been studying Numbers 15 for the last 12 years and certainly would have come across verse 37 that says, "The Lord said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and say to them, throughout the generations to come, you are to make tassels on the corners of your garments with a blue cord on each tassel. And you will have these tassels to look at, and so you will remember all the commands of Yahweh, that you may obey them and not prostitute yourselves by going out after the lusts of your own hearts and eyes. Then you will remember to obey all my commands and will be consecrated to your God." So God had prescribed a physical reminder to remind the people to obey his word. And Jesus obeyed that command. He followed all of the law. He was a Jew and he dressed like a Jew. It was very obvious that he was a Jew. When he went over to the Gentile territory, they would have immediately known as soon as they saw him wearing the tassels and all the Jewish paraphernalia and everything else, they would have known right away that he's a Jew. And he wore these tassels on his garment as a reminder for him to obey God's word. And so this woman works her way up through the crowd, squeezes up through, and waits for a little opening. Gets close to Jesus, suddenly sees an opportunity, reaches out her hand, and she must have been down close to the ground. I don't know if she was down on her hands or knees, whatever, but reaches and just for a moment closes her hand around one of the tassels and then lets go. And at that split second, Christ's healing power courses through her body and she is healed. And she knows it. Verse 29, immediately her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. The Lord not only instantly cured her, but he gave her some kind of a sensation and knowledge that that enabled her to know that she was well. Now look at Jesus' response in verse 30. "At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him." Now stop there a second. That's really, I think, a fascinating verse. This is one of the most mysterious pictures of Jesus' human nature and his divine nature. It's kind of like the stilling of the storm we saw a few weeks ago. Remember, in his human nature, he was so tired he couldn't keep his eyes open. His divine nature has the power to still a storm. Here, in his divine nature, the power went out from him because he willed it to. He, as God the Son, decided that in response to this woman's touch of faith, he was going to heal her. But in his human nature, he just feels some kind of a sensation and knows that power went out from him. And we don't really know how much he knew. We know there's some things in his human nature that he didn't know. We don't know at this point what, but he turns around, verse 30, and turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" And the thing that I always get a kick out of in Luke's account says, as soon as he asked that question, they all denied it. Now, why do you suppose they denied it? They've been touching him like, they've been all mashed up against him. They're pressing the life out of him practically. They're choking him out. And then they say, wasn't me. I don't know why they would do that. Evidently they thought they had an idea there was more to it than just physically coming in contact. And they didn't know what, but whatever it was, it wasn't them. You ever have your kids do that? Hey, who did? It wasn't me. And they haven't even said it yet. They seem to give the impression that the way that Jesus asked this question, who touched my clothes, must have been somewhat intimidating. And they seem to expect a rebuke of some kind, whoever it was. And so they all denied it, including the woman. I don't know what you mean by that, but it wasn't me. And so if we combine Luke and Mark's account, we get Jesus' full response. Peter speaks up. And in verse 31, Peter says, "You see the people crowding against you, and you ask, 'Who touched me?' But Jesus said, 'Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me.'" That's the difference between a pressing crowd and the touch of faith. Augustine said, "Flesh presses, faith touches." It's really a profound statement if you think about it. Flesh presses, faith touches. The crowd is there. They showed up to see Jesus. They're interested. They drop whatever they're doing to be there. They make a commitment to come. They're following along. But they seem to gain absolutely no benefit at all from Christ. Because theirs is the pressing of flesh, not the grasp of faith. What an illustration that is of just countless churches around the world who are jammed full of people who come on Sundays and press up against Christ in a mob mentality. Millions of people seem to be reaching up a sea of hands to Christ, but Christ can see which ones are the touch of faith. One person in a massive throng of people who don't really care about Christ can reach out in true faith, and Christ can see that. In response, when they respond to the stirrings of faith in their heart. Okay, verse 32, Jesus kept looking. They're all sitting there denying it, and he's drawing this thing out. He wants to see, and he keeps looking, and he's looking through the crowd, scanning around, and he keeps on looking to see who had done it. Now, Jesus has stopped now. He's scanning out the crowd, and the crowd is saying, "It wasn't me, I didn't do it," and a little circle now opens up around Jesus, a little perimeter of people as they back off. And I was studying this, and I had to stop in my study and ask myself, wait a minute, if you don't know who touched you, what good does it do to keep on looking for him? How is that going to help? And the only conclusion I could come to is Jesus must have known. He's looking to make eye contact with the person. He's got to know who it is, or it wouldn't do any good to look for him. And by the way, there is a little bit of a textual hint that Jesus knew, because when in verse 32 when it says he was looking to see who touched him, the word "who" there is feminine. And so it's like he's saying he's looking to see which woman touched him. So I think Jesus did know who it was. At this point, the woman is scared out of her mind. She's desperate to stay out of view. She's backing off. The people keep backing off. She's trying to stay behind somebody, keep out of Jesus' view. She's trying to appear inconspicuous, which if you've ever done that, you know that every move you make seems like it's as conspicuous as it can be. But finally, Jesus' searching eyes zero in, and his eyes lock onto her, and their eyes see each other, and she knows at this moment there's no more hiding. She's caught. But she finds out that his purpose was not to rebuke her, but to make personal contact with her. He didn't have to do that. Now, ask yourself, why does he want to do this? He could have just kept walking, right? He could have just kept walking and thought to himself, "Oh, that dear lady was just healed. Isn't that wonderful?" And just walked on. But he stops and makes a point to make this contact. I think there's a couple of very important reasons why he did that. First of all, she needed to know, and this is the most important thing, she needed and we need to know that it was not her superstitious touch of a of a garment that healed her. It was her faith that healed her, and Jesus wants to make a point of that. And so he stops, makes contact with her, and tells her that. Salvation does not come by touching some holy relic. And that's worth noticing, because to this day we have people all around the world who are superstitious, and they believe if they touch Jesus' burial cloth, or if they get close to some bone of John the Baptist, or whatever relic that there's millions of around the world, especially in many Catholic traditions, people think that by being near those physical things, they can somehow get grace from God. That is just simply pagan superstition. There is no physical action you can do to get grace from God. And that kind of superstition needs to be corrected, and so Jesus does. In verse 34, he tells her, look, it's not your touch, it's your faith that healed you. Many in this crowd touched him, and no power went out from him when they touched him. But Jesus allows his healing power to be released in response to her touch because it was a touch of faith. God responds to faith. So that's one reason. I think there's another reason, though. It was an act of kindness for Jesus to single this woman out. It was uncomfortable for her, but what he's doing is he's making her healing public. Remember, she's an outcast. And everyone needs to know that there's no longer any reason for her to be ostracized. She's whole. She's well. She's clean now. She can be embraced. So verse 33, the woman, knowing what had happened to her, and then Luke says, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came and fell at his feet. So now Jesus is there. He sees her. Soon as he sees her, she just steps out of the crowd into that open area and falls down at Jesus' feet. Now there's another person falling at Jesus' feet. Just like the sinful woman at the Pharisee's house, she approaches Jesus and then falls at his feet. Now picture this. The people have backed off, no doubt. There's this empty space. Jesus says, who touched me? She comes forward, falls at his feet, and verse 33 says she's shaking, trembling with what? Fear. There it is again. Everyone who encounters Jesus' divine power has that same response. Luke says, right in the presence of all the people, she told him the whole truth, why she had touched him, and how she had been instantly healed. Now everybody knows. And when she said that, when she said what her problem was, everyone must have gasped and instantly backed away. Now they're irritated at her. Everyone who had just bumped against her is now unclean. And that's an annoyance. And she's been standing there utterly alone in the crowd. You can imagine them angrily looking at her. And Jesus, verse 34, said to her, daughter, your faith has healed, saved you, literally. Go into peace and be freed from your suffering. Jesus, so gentle, so tender. He calls her daughter. And let me just tell you this. If you want to understand the meaning of this particular miracle, just take a pen and underline the word daughter as many times as you can fit in there in the lines of your Bible, because that's the main point of everything that's being done here. That is the key to understanding this whole event. Let me explain why. Jesus does not call her woman like he did with his own mother. He does not call her sister, even though just the day before in Matthew 12:48, he described believers who are in his family as his sisters, disciples, female disciples as his sisters. He might refer to women as sisters or mothers, or he also said that, or his own mother he referred to as woman. Never does he ever call anybody daughter, except here. This is the only place. You say, well, so what? Why is that so important? It's very important, and it's, if you can just lift yourself away from the trees and see the forest here again for a second. Remember the setting. Where was Jesus going at this moment? Jairus' house, right. And what was he going to do? Heal his little daughter. And who is probably standing impatiently right by Jesus' side during this whole event with the woman? A very anxious Jairus. This takes place, this event takes place right in the middle of the account of Jesus going to heal this other man's daughter. Now Matthew, this is very fascinating, Matthew, for his own theological purposes, takes this event, removes it from its chronological order, puts it into another context of another time of Jesus' life, and reports it then because he's more topical in his approach. However, he also takes the Jairus account with it and reports them both together. All three Gospels, wherever this appears in their chronology, have this event happen right in the middle of the Jairus event. And the reason for that is they go together. They're making a single point. You have to see the thing with Jairus in order to understand what's going on with this woman. When Jesus calls this woman daughter, he's making a tremendous statement to the crowd and to Jairus and to this woman and to us. You see, you and I, when we read this account, we just think, oh, we're reading the old story about the woman with an issue of blood. We've heard this all our lives. We've heard this miracle account. And we're thinking that that's the point. Keep in mind, this crowd is not thinking about this woman. This is just an interruption to them. They are thinking, everybody there, Jairus, the crowd, the disciples, everybody's dialed in completely on Jairus' daughter. Jesus stops, says, who touched me? This weird thing's going on, but still, they're totally focused on Jairus' daughter. I guarantee you, when your 12-year-old daughter is on the verge of death and there's a prospect of her maybe being healed, if the healer would just hurry up and stop messing around, in that context, you do not see an ostracized woman. You don't see Jesus' compassion. You don't see a great healing. You don't learn a lesson. All you see is one big, fat, maddening delay. Be like if your child were being rushed to the hospital in flight for life, and all of a sudden the helicopter stops to pick up somebody who's had some condition for 12 years. Maybe it's serious, but hardly emergent. And the whole time Jesus has stopped looking around the crowd for who touched him, talking to this woman, all that's going on, Jairus is standing there watching it all, thinking not about her, but about his daughter. His heart is crushed. A dying 12-year-old daughter will draw out of a man the highest level of emotion and compassion that's possible for a human being to experience. His heart is just bleeding to the highest conceivable degree of emotion. And the crowd's hearts must have ached for this guy and for his daughter, and everybody's fixated on that. And right in the middle of all of that, the matchless Christ, who's just always the master of the moment, the most brilliant teacher ever lived, forces everyone's attention on this unclean outcast and calls her my daughter. You see that? That's the thing about Jesus' miracles. You don't even really have to teach them. All you have to do is just describe the setting, and they teach themselves. Meaning becomes obvious. In the middle of the context of Jairus' concern for his dying daughter, Jesus stops and lets everyone know, Jairus, I feel towards this woman the same way you feel towards your dying daughter. That's why I use the word daughter. This is my precious little girl. This woman who disgusts everyone who sees her, who has been shoved into the margins of society, rejected, unclean, contaminating, ostracized, the kind of person no one wants to be around. This woman who is unclean, unloved, unlovely, undesirable. When I see her, the emotions that course through me are the same emotions that you feel for your precious little girl at home. And so the Lord orchestrates events so as to create a striking illustration to show the intensity of his love for everyone, especially the defiled outcast. So now you see why this miracle is right in the middle of the other miracle, and why all the gospel writers are faithful to report the miracle in the context of the other miracle, because they both go together to make the one point. Now think about the implications of this. Is there a woman, a man, in the church that you can't stand to be around? Is there someone you just want to avoid? Think about the Lord's level of compassion for that person. Think of the intensity of his emotions for that person. Like an only daughter who's about to die as a child. That's the degree of emotion he has for the person. And then think about this. 1 John 4:11, dear friends, since God so loved us, we ought also to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. The heart of the Christian towards others is like that of Christ. If he says to the outcast out at the fringes, "My daughter," what are we going to say? And maybe you look at it from the other perspective. Maybe you are the outcast. You are the one who's pushed out to the fringes in some context. Christ has this kind of love and this level of concern for you. Just like for this woman. If you think back in the terminology of Matthew 12, this bruised reed in front of him, he didn't break it and throw it away. This smoldering faith in front of him, he didn't snuff it out, but fanned it into flame and sent her away into peace, verse 48. Well, there are a couple things that I think we need to learn from this, and a few observations I want to make. First, I think this really serves as an excellent illustration of confession. The whole principle about confession. Now, it's not that this woman had done anything wrong or she was confessing any sin, but still, it was all so embarrassing and humiliating for her. But when she told the whole truth, suddenly her terror and trembling melted away, and a wave of relief flooded her soul. That's the way it is with confession. Like millions before her, she found that when she confessed to the Lord, she found him to be gentle and kind and not harsh. She was afraid to expose the ugliness of her life to Christ. But the moment she did, Christ responded by exposing to the crowd and to the world and the church of the ages the beauty of her faith. And that's how confession works. You expose the ugliness of your sin to God, and God in turn washes you clean and then exposes that righteousness to the world and to you. Another thing that you really can't help but to notice about this is how accessible and approachable Jesus was. He was touchable. You didn't have to set an appointment with the secretary of one of the disciples' assistants in order to see Jesus. I mean, Jesus is always right there among the people. He's not way out ahead of the group as they're walking along. He's not surrounded by a bunch of bodyguards. He's not elevated above everyone, not whisked away, you know, when he arrived at the shore and the boat whisked away by some stretch chariot or whatever. He was accessible. He's the most famous personality in Israel at this point, and anyone could just walk right up and touch him. You know, some people believe they're above that. They imagine themselves to be so important they can't mingle with the common people or allow themselves to be touched, certainly not by some unclean, contaminating influence. They have people that they hire to deal with that. And Jesus could have been like that. He had the disciples. And for him, it would have been justified. I mean, you know, some people are aloof because they think they're superior to everybody, and they're wrong. But Jesus really was superior to everyone else and would have been fully justified in acting that way if he'd wanted to. He could have said, especially in this case, I mean, he could have said to this woman, "Look, not now. Let go of my garment." Or as some people have said, "Don't hassle my tassel." You know, I'm involved in something very important here. This will have to wait. And who could fault him for doing that? I mean, he's the king of the universe. He's not obligated to stop and take care of every little need of every obscure little person. But Jesus wasn't like that. He could have been above everyone, but he wasn't. He showed no favoritism. This rich, important, influential man needed help. And if Jesus gets him on board, you know, with his movement, he could maybe really help get things going in Capernaum. Jesus is on his way to help, but on the way, an outcast, unclean, defiled woman needs help, and he stops and pays just as much attention to her. You know, they say that when you start a new ministry, when you plant a church especially, you need a specific demographic that you target. And you read the books about that, and of course the target is always somebody, always some desirable kind of a person. You know, the wealthy person that has it all together. Rich, young, healthy, happy people. Nobody really targets the people like this woman in their demographic. Some hopeless, defiled person with medical problems. We want to target the people, the kind of people we're after, you know, that we need, that can have something to offer us. Meanwhile, James 2 says, "Suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes, and a poor man in shabby clothes also comes in. If you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, 'Here's a good seat for you,' but to the poor man you say, 'Stand over there,' or 'Sit here at my feet,' have you not discriminated among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts?" That is favoritism. and it's forbidden, it's wrong. And you say, well, wait a minute, we're just trying to show love. You know, if you read those books, they'll say, we're just loving these people. I mean, somebody's got to reach those attractive people. Verse 8 addresses that in James 2. He says, if you really keep the royal law found in Scripture, love your neighbor as yourself, you're doing good. But if you show favoritism, you sin and are convicted by the law as a lawbreaker. And that illustration there is with money, but it can be applied to anything. Someone comes into the church and they're just the kind of person we need. They've got some skill, they got some talent, they got whatever. We show them all kinds of hospitality. But someone else comes in who isn't like us, dresses different, worships different, doesn't seem to have anything to offer, seems in fact to be kind of a drain on us. Are we going to show less excitement, less hospitality towards a person like that? This favoritism can be very subtle. Well, a third point I want to point out is we can't miss the strong statement here Jesus is making about family. The term daughter is more than just implying tenderness and love. There's something more to it than that. It implies relationship. Just the day before in Matthew 12:48, Jesus had said, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? Pointing to his disciples, he said, here are my mother and brothers, for whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. The people in Christ's family, the true family of Christ, are the people who believe. Even more so than Mary, who was standing right there when Jesus said that. She came with his brothers, and Jesus wouldn't even go out and talk to her. He says, that's not my mother and brothers. These are my mother and brothers, pointing to his disciples. You've heard that blood is thicker than water, but faith is thicker than blood. Jesus continuously taught that relationship to him is based on faith. Jesus is indicating here that this woman is part of his family. She's saved, as we said before. She's a child of God. She just became a relative of Christ. Not by any religious achievement, but by her faith alone. Which is amazing. Amazing. I mean, think about that. Mary herself, the Blessed Virgin, the Blessed One, came to him the day before, and he wouldn't even go out to see her. And he said, that's not my true family. This woman is. If Mary's blessed to be Jesus' earthly mother, then this woman is exceedingly blessed to be in his spiritual family. Kind of makes you think twice about some of the negative thoughts we have towards unbelievers, doesn't it? I mean, towards other believers. The next time you catch yourself gossiping about someone, or even more commonly that, putting someone down in your own mind and your own thoughts, gossiping about them, what a dummy, what a jerk, you know, he's not very committed, she's shallow, he's arrogant, whatever. Imagine Jesus standing there saying, hey, that's my daughter. So now this woman is no longer alone. Jesus takes her on as a dependent, his own daughter. So during this whole episode, as this is going on, somebody runs up now. This thing has just happened with the woman. Jesus has finally focused everyone's attention when he says the word daughter. Must have absolutely captivated everyone's attention there. Now up runs this messenger to Jairus and tells him it's too late. His daughter's gone. Verse 35. While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler, and said, your daughter is dead. And then they go on to say, why trouble the teacher anymore? Why bother him? Give it up. It's too late. She's gone. And then verse 36, just quickly. Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, don't be afraid. Just believe. Again, we see this, and we'll close with this, but we see this ongoing conflict that we've been watching all along, started with the boat and the storm, between faith and fear. We saw it over in the region of the Gerasenes, we saw it in the boat, we saw the woman go through it, now we see Jairus go through it. And that's always the question, are you going to fear circumstances or fear God? Are you going to be intimidated by the way things appear visually, or are you going to trust God with your life? The word translated ignoring means, it can mean to ignore or to overhear. Either way, though, it comes out with the same idea. Obviously, Jesus overhears them and he ignores them. And it's interesting. I don't know. You know, these guys have the legacy of being the only ones in the Bible says Jesus ignored. If you seek advice and somebody counsels you to operate by faith or by sight only and not by faith, then Christ is ignoring that person. You might as well go ahead and ignore them too. But I just want you to think of the battle in this guy's mind right now between faith and fear. He's facing that struggle. Fighting the temptation to give in to the strictly naturalistic perspective. Going on the way things appear, giving into fear, giving into anxiety, giving into worry, giving into anger, depression. But Jesus helps him out and he says, keep on believing, don't be afraid. Trust is scary. People scream on roller coasters because even though they trust those rails with their life, still, they're scared. It's enough. There's the apparent danger is enough to get the adrenaline pumping. It's even scarier than that to trust in a person. And it's really that fear, and I want you to think this through, it's that fear that's the power supply that gives force to temptation. That's what makes obedience hard. For example, God commands us to forgive one another and to overlook offenses, right? We're tempted to retaliate when someone hurts us, and you know, if somebody hurts me, suppose Tracy does something that hurts me. I face the temptation to retaliate by being harsh with her with my words. When I do something that hurts her, she faces the same temptation, the temptation to retaliate punish me with silent treatment or whatever. And then God comes along and says to us, just forgive. And I'm thinking in my mind, wait a minute, if I don't do something, she'll never learn. And Christ says, trust me. Just trust me. Just forgive. Trust me to take care of teaching her whatever she needs to be taught. And I'm thinking, if I just always forgive, I may have to live the rest of my life being hurt again and again in the same way. And I face a prospect of that for the rest of my life. You realize that, Lord? And the Lord says, just trust me. Just forgive. People don't want to give up grudges. They don't want to give up sinful habits. They don't want to give up worldly influences. They don't want to give up destructive relationships. They don't want to give up all those things. We don't want to give up the things God calls us to give up because we're afraid of what life will be like without those things. And Jesus says to us, the same thing that he said to Jairus, don't be afraid, just believe.